Sometime in 1768, a young Englishman disembarked from a ship in New York Harbor. He was there to arrange a supply of lumber for the plantation he and his brother had inherited in the Caribbean. Looking around, he evidently decided he liked what he saw, because he didn't return to the plantation. Instead, he stayed in America, becoming a judge, a colonel in the Continental Army, a congressman, a friend and second-in-command of Alexander Hamilton's newly formed Treasury Department, before ending his days in debtor's prison, a residence he probably chose for himself to escape lynching by a mob of his creditors. The story today, like many good stories, has a hero and a villain. Actually, quite a lot of villains, as is normal where money is concerned. The hero is Hamilton, he of the $10 note, the star of sold-out hip-hop musicals, and the victim of a deadly duel with Vice President Aaron Burr. The villain is William Dewar, the upper-class Englishman, like many good villains, whom we saw stepping off the boat in search of opportunities and lumber. And because a story is more fun when told from the side of the villain, that's what we're going to do. Hello, and welcome to Alexander Hamilton and the First U.S. Financial Frenzy, Series 1, Episode 5 of Boom and Bust, the podcast that delves into financial meltdowns through the ages. Today, we're heading back to just post-independence America and the Panic of 1792. This might have put paid to the newly minted United States' efforts to set up something like a modern financial system, had it been allowed to spiral out of control. Fortunately for the states, it didn't. By creating a modern financial system, the new nation was able to pay for the 1803 Louisiana Purchase with bonds, nearly doubling in size. Emperor Napoleon then sold the bonds, mainly to rich Englishmen, and used the money to buy weapons, with which he went to war on, among others, the English. I discussed the Louisiana and French in North America in the first part of my podcast about John Law and the Mississippi System, 70 or so years prior to the events we're discussing here. The French interest in North America is a sort of postscript today, confined as it is to Canada's Quebec province. But in the 18th century, the French were major players. Louisiana, or New France, was huge. It sprawled over the present-day states of Louisiana, of course, Mississippi, Arkansas, Missouri, Illinois, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. The crisis that Dewar provoked supplied Hamilton's opponents, including President-to-be Thomas Jefferson, who actually bought New France, with almost enough political ammunition to bring Hamilton's reforms to a juddering halt. Almost. However, it became the first American financial meltdown and a template for pretty much all subsequent US busts. Wild speculation, frenzy, collapse, and government intervention. At the centre of it all is Dewar, whose antics forced Hamilton to invent procedures for handling a bust. Fully 9 decades before Walter Bagot teased out the principles, largely unchanged to this day, in his book Lombard Street. Hamilton, by the way, handled the bust so successfully and with so little long-term fallout that the Panic of 1792 is hardly mentioned in the literature. That isn't to say it was entirely without consequences, though. It prompted the founding of a political faction opposed to Hamilton's reforms. This was dubbed the Democrats. While not really the ancestors of the current political party, they were essentially a political party, and President Washington opposed party politics. Another result was the founding of the New York Stock Exchange beneath a buttonwood tree on Wall Street. And efforts to raise tax revenue after the panic subsided, sparked the Whiskey Rebellion, an armed uprising against the federal government that took place in 1794. And that's a pretty good name for a rebellion, the Whiskey Rebellion. Dewar was born in 1743 or 1747, we don't know which for sure, into a well-off family of the sort that dominated rural England, the so-called squirearchy. He attended Eton College, then an essential stop in the life of a youthful member of the elite, not so different from today really, before leaving for India to join Robert Lord Clive, the man who laid the ground for the British Raj. If anyone is interested in finding out more about Clive and his very questionable role as the sociopathic conqueror of India, I can recommend a book called The Anarchy by William Dalrymple. Dewar was quickly forced back to England by illness. From there, he went to the West Indies, where he inherited a plantation on the island of Dominica, together with his brother. Under the Treaty of Paris of 1763, which ended the 7 Years' War in Europe, France ceded Dominica to Britain, along with St. Vincent and Grenada, more islands. The Dewar family also had plantations on Antigua and was probably among the beneficiaries when slave owners were compensated after their slaves on the island of Antigua were freed. A search on the University College London website, it's called Legacies of British Slave Ownership, throws up lots of Dewars on Antigua, but I can't find any mention of Dominica. Be that as it may, in 1768, Dewar arrived in America. Throughout his career, he tested the boundaries of acceptable business practices for a public servant. Well, for basically anyone, really. And ultimately overstepped them. He contributed both to the success and subsequent failure of Hamilton's barely remembered Society for Establishing Useful Manufactures, as well as to the success of the first central bank of the United States. The America that Dewar stepped into in 1768 was already in ferment, even before the guns began firing at Lexington and Concord in 1775. In many ways, society was a reflection of England of the time, intensely class-conscious, but nevertheless offering plentiful opportunities to those willing to seize them. Dewar was ready, very ready. Indeed, and being ready to seize an opportunity was among things that marked him out throughout his life. His background in the landed gentry helped him enter what you might call the right circles, the elite. He borrowed £1,400, a huge amount of money at the time, from his sister, and used it to buy land at Fort Miller on the Hudson River. There, he gained the patronage of one Philip Schuyler, one of the grandees of the colony, and the father of Elizabeth, the bride-to-be of Alexander Hamilton. When Dewar married Catherine Alexander in 1779, the bride was given away by none other than George Washington. Like many Englishmen in America at the time, Dewar had spotted more opportunities by siding with the rebels than with the colonial power. He joined the Continental Army as an aide to Schuyler, who was a major general. While he continued to be active in business, he clearly understood the importance of political connections, joining the New York Provincial Congress in 1776, in July of that year. The following March, he was chosen to represent New York in the Continental Congress, and he was careful to look for and cultivate those who would be in a position to help him in later life. According to Robert F. Jones, in his biography of Dewar, the King of the Alley, among the most important relationships he established was that with Robert Morris, the Superintendent of Finance, also known as the financier of the revolution. Contracts he obtained included agreements to supply the French and Spanish navies with masts and spars, and in June 1781 he won a contract to supply food to French troops as they passed through New York, Jones reports. And of course, the French were at war with the English at the time. As is often the case with people who end up causing massive financial meltdowns, he doesn't appear to have been troubled by an excess of scruple. Those contracts were in the name of Daniel Parker & Co., a firm which was jointly owned by Dewar, Parker, and John Holker, the French naval agent in Philadelphia, according to Jones. Dewar left the Philadelphia-based firm in 1783 when he moved to New York, and the firm collapsed the following year. Parker fled to Europe, having lost the company's money in a quote-unquote personal speculation, and he took its records with him. In 1785, Dewar became a clerk to the Board of the Treasury, which had replaced Morris, and then became secretary to the Board of the Treasury at a salary of $1,800 a year. His entrepreneurial activities continued, and he doesn't appear to have been particularly fussy about the type of business he got involved in. According to Jones, an Englishman named James Jarvis came up with a plan to mint copper into cents and then lend them to the Treasury at 6% interest. The board approved the idea and left it to Dewar to arrange the details. Jarvis later claimed that Dewar had insisted on him signing an IOU for $10,000 before the contract could be written. A few coins were actually minted and apparently are now collector's items, but Jarvis basically ran out of copper and nothing much came of the affair. Jones reports that Jarvis may well have been a frontman for a scheme devised by Dewar and Andrew Craigie, a noted speculator. Dewar also took an $8,000 bribe from Craigie, who wanted to get a claim against the government assigned to him and to have an attachment against him withdrawn. That's pretty corrupt by today's standards and, to be honest, probably by 18th century standards too. Before we get into any more of Dewar's antics, we need to set the scene, financially speaking. Because, like pretty much every revolution before and since, the American one had swept in on a tide of depreciated, or practically worthless, paper. The states had issued their own currencies and floated their own loans. Sometimes these were backed by real assets, such as Virginia's tobacco certificates. These were receipts that a certain amount of tobacco had been deposited with a state warehouse. But sometimes these were backed by nothing more than the word of a legislature or a bank with empty vaults. In his book, A Nation of Deadbeats, Scott Reynolds Nelson notes, for example, that it didn't take long for Virginian banks to stash these tobacco receipts in their vaults and use them to back their own banknotes. A pledge upon a pledge, as he puts it. He also points out that the real backing for most of the state's debts was the amount of land they would be able to sell off at some point in the future. Hence, Virginia's debt was a better bet than that of Little Maryland, simply because it was a bigger state with more land it could put on the block. Naturally, by 1783, when the Treaty of Paris ended the American War of Independence, the US debt needed, in modern terminology, to be restructured. And that meant instituting a financial revolution of the sort that Holland and England had already gone through. The French attempt at this modernisation had foundered on the wreckage of John Law's Mississippi system, delaying reform until the Revolution of 1789. Thanks to Hamilton, in the US, this financial revolution happened and survived. According to a paper by David Cowan, Richard Siller and Robert Wright, when Hamilton left the Treasury in 1795, the US had the makings of a modern financial system. These makings included stable public finances and debt management, stable money, an effective central bank, a functioning banking system, active securities markets, and a growing number of financial and non-financial corporations. In September 1789, when Hamilton was appointed to the Treasury, they point out, it had none of these things. Here, I should apologise in advance to US listeners because the section I'm about to recount probably isn't any sort of news to them at all. However, outside of the US, this stuff isn't widely known among the general public. In 1790, Hamilton proposed that the government would assume the war debt of the states, with interest payments to start in 1792. While he gave domestic investors what's known as a haircut by reducing interest payments to 4% from 6%, he insisted on honouring foreign debt on its original terms. There was talk that Dewar, then Hamilton's assistant, took advantage of inside knowledge. Here's Scott Reynolds. Quote, "While Dewar was in prison, many remembered him as the owner of a fast sloop that travelled through the Chesapeake Bay area, collecting depreciated state notes at knockdown prices, hours before news arrived that the general government would pay them off." End quote. He also reports that Dewar bought loans that he would later resell to the government, using money borrowed from Dutch merchants. The new Treasury debt consisted of 6% bonds that would pay interest starting in 1791, 6% deferred bonds that would start paying interest only 10 years later, in 1801, and 3% bonds. Active markets trading them emerged in Philadelphia, New York, and Boston as soon as the new notes appeared in 1790. I'm telling you this with these details because these bonds and their terms become important a bit further down the line. Hamilton's next move was, in effect, a debt for equity swap. The equity was to be that of the Bank of the United States, the BUS, the nation's newly minted central bank, which Hamilton proposed in 1790. The BUS would hold taxes, make short-term loans to the government, and hold money going in and out of the country, according to Brian Taylor, who is the chief economist at the Californian data firm Global Financial Data. Importantly, its banknotes could be used to pay taxes. Notes from other banks could not. Its main goal, though, was to promote business by lending to entrepreneurs and merchants. In short, it was a commercial bank. Its foundation prompted the states to incorporate more banks of their own. Banks make loans, so the result was to send more credit swirling through the economy. Hamilton's inspiration here was clearly the Bank of England, which in turn was modelled on earlier Dutch institutions. And the debt for equity swap wasn't new either. That had been carried out by the BOE, in France by John Law's Mississippi system, the Compagnie des Indes, and had been given another road test by Britain's South Sea Company. Everything's relative, and the new BUS was, relatively speaking, a monster. Its initial capital was $10 million, made up of 25,000 shares of $400 each. This compares with the government's revenue in 1791 of $4.4 million, Taylor points out. The government would put up $2 million of the BUS capital, with the rest subscribed by private investors. As you can see, $400 was a lot of money back at the end of the 18th century. The way the new bank's share sale worked was clever, and it opened the door to some clever financial shenanigans. Hamilton had clearly been taking lessons from the likes of John Law and the promoters of the South Sea Company, because it went very much like their issuances did. So, let's take a closer look. Basically, when the BUS went public in July 1791, all you could buy was an option, known as a scrip. $25 in silver or gold got you the right to buy a $400 share in the BUS. You then had to pay another $100 each in January and July of 1792, as well as in January 1793. The final $75 was due in July 1793. Here's the clever part. $25 of each payment had to be made in precious metal, with $75 in US debt. So, assuming the IPO went well and BUS shares were in demand, US government bonds would be in demand too. Their price would go up, and if you didn't have enough of them when you bought the scrip, you would have to obtain more or sell out to someone who had the bonds or the money to buy them. Someone wealthy, like William Dewar, perhaps. Although many congressmen happened to get lucky, so to speak, in the BUS IPO. Price movements from Philadelphia, New York, and Boston, they all had their own exchanges, collected by Cohen, Siller, and Wright, show that prices of US sixes jumped in July and August 1791, as well as in the following December and January. Those booms were followed by crashes. There were also wild swings in prices between January and March 1792 in New York, which was where speculation was focused, before the bust came later in March. To give a flavour of what went on during the scrip bubble, the $25 scrips doubled in price until early August, when they soared, reaching more than $300 in Philadelphia on August the 11th. Then they tumbled, falling to less than $160 in New York on August the 16th. They were bid at $125 in Philadelphia that same day. Government bonds also gained. A bondholder generally gets paid in two ways. First, there are the interest payments as promised, and then the principal, the face value of the note, is repaid. The price an investor will pay for a bond reflects that person's view of the future, including the direction of interest rates and the likelihood of the principal being fully repaid. The post-revolutionary US was not a great credit. At the time of the BUS share sale in 1791, you could buy a $1 bond for 60 cents. In other words, investors viewed it as unlikely that the US government would repay that dollar, plus interest, in sufficient time, if at all, for that sum of money to be worth more than 60 cents in mid-1791. Then, it turned out you could use the bond to part pay for a share in a large bank that was clearly being set up by the Treasury to make a lot of money. The sixes hit 112.5 in Philadelphia on August the 13th. Then they headed down as speculators got cold feet, sliding to 100 cents or par on August 17th. So, after getting the requisite approval, Hamilton authorized William Seton, cashier of the Bank of New York, an institution he himself had founded, to buy as much as $150,000 of public debt. He was clear that he wanted it to be known that the government was stepping in to support the market. In a letter to Seton, he wrote, quote, "You recollect that the Act requires that the purchase should be made openly. This has been construed to mean by a known agent for the public. When you make a purchase, therefore, it will be proper that it should be understood that it is on account of the United States. But this need not precede the purchase." End quote. In other words, make the purchase, and when you've done so, make sure people know about it. Another $50,000 was used to buy more bonds, and by early September, the market had stabilized. About $150,000 was also spent in Philadelphia. Face value of the securities acquired was more than $560,000 because the so-called deferreds and the threes were bought at prices well below par. The purchases amounted to about 2% of the debt stock outstanding at the time, according to Cowan and Co. By comparison, and a fairly meaningless comparison to be honest, a similar portion of the current debt stock would be in the region of $330 billion, a very large amount. Dürer was a driving force in the script bubble, according to Taylor at Global Financial Data, who cites a letter from Hamilton scolding him. So, with the letter in hand, Dürer did the obvious thing. He doubled down. Dürer and Alexander Makem, a wealthy real estate speculator, and others, got together to set up a pool known as the 6% Club. This aimed to corner the market in government debt. They wanted to buy up all the available public securities, the paper that could be used to pay for stock in the Bank of the United States. The idea was that anyone wishing to pay for their stock in the BUS in July 1792 would have to come to them to obtain it, meaning that they could charge pretty much what they liked. And who would be eager to buy? Why? Among many others, wealthy French aristocrats fleeing the Revolution and Madame la Guillotine, and looking for a safe home and gainful employment for their cash. This was a great idea, but only in theory. If the price moved against them, Dürer and Co., who were using borrowed money as well as their own capital, would be in serious trouble, and that's exactly what happened. The 6% Club made the purchases in December and January using money they'd borrowed, typically for 90 days. They also co-signed each other's notes, IOUs that could be discounted at a bank, that is, cashed in for a figure a bit lower than face value. The way things worked at the time, this meant that they were all on the hook for each other's debts if the primary signatory couldn't pay. Credit was plentiful, booming, in fact. The BUS opened for business in December 1791, and its loans and the banknotes it issued helped to fuel a credit boom. Other newly minted banks were also eager to lend, so securities the 6% Club bought at January prices had to be paid for in March, when the idea was that bonds would have gone up in price. In effect, the Club had bought bond futures in the thousands. They also appear to have bought scrip, the paper that gave holders the option to take part in the purchase of the new bank's shares in coming months. And while an option gives the holder the right to buy or sell a security, a future, which is a contract to take delivery of some asset at a predetermined price at some future date, imposes an obligation. The buyer is betting on a rising price. As Dürer and the 6% Club would find out very quickly, that can also be a losing wager. By February, two things had happened to signal the approaching catastrophe. According to Scott Reynolds, a contract that Dürer held to supply the army had blown up in his face. In November 1791, the shoddy goods his agents had supplied to an expedition against the Indians led to the deaths of 600 soldiers. By February the following year, word of his role in the disaster had got back to the eastern cities, setting off the nation's first congressional investigation. His reputation was in tatters. Added to that, the boom was getting out of hand, and Hamilton was suggesting that the nation's banks begin to draw in their horns. Quote, "Every existing bank ought, within prudent limits, to abridge its operations. The superstructure of credit is now too vast for the foundation. It must gradually be brought within a more reasonable dimensions, or it will tumble." End quote. That was in a letter to Seaton at the Bank of New York. But we can be sure that the message was getting out to other lenders, particularly the BUS, which in any case was overextended. The Bank of New York was also under attack from Hamilton's political opponents and opponents of the BUS. who were withdrawing precious metal from it, forcing it in turn to demand repayment from its own creditors. Unable to borrow from the usual sources, Dürer and his club turned to the hoi polloi. They borrowed from stevedores, carters, barmen, butchers, shopkeepers, you name it. Quote, even the noted bored Mrs. McCarty, end quote, lent him money. Interest was charged at 3% to 6% a month. The final straw, though, came when Oliver Wolcott, the comptroller of the treasury, heard of Dürer's distress and, acting to save his own skin, asked the Attorney General to sue for the $236,000 that Dürer had to settle with the Treasury. Apparently he had borrowed the money from Hamilton's attempt at an industrial policy, the Society for Establishing Useful Manufactures, of which he was chairman and chief salesman, and he hadn't got around to repaying it. On March the 9th, 1792, Dürer stopped paying his creditors. He tried to play down the importance of the move, while frantically pulling strings to have the suit withdrawn. To no avail. On March the 23rd, he was either arrested or he turned himself in at the city jail for his own protection. There, he was joined by other members of his coterie. As word spread, there was rioting outside the jail. If Mrs. McCarty, the noted brothel keeper, had countersigned Dürer's promissory note and taken it to a bank for cash, she now found herself on the hook for the full amount. Many more people were now in that position, leading to panic selling as borrowers attempted to raise money, bringing much normal business to a grinding halt. Already on March the 19th, Hamilton had written to Seton at the Bank of New York to begin what we would now call lender of last resort operations, urging him to consider, quote, how much more can be done in favour of parties who can pledge public stock as collateral security, end quote. He was looking to make it easy for merchants to pay customs duties that were shortly coming due, recommending the BUS make, quote, every reasonable accommodation, end quote. He also authorised further bond purchases. 90 years later, in 1873, Bagot would write that cash lent by a central bank during a panic should, quote, if possible, stay the panic. And for this purpose, there are two rules. First, that these loans should only be made at a very high rate of interest. Secondly, that at this rate, these advances should be made on all good banking securities and as largely as the public ask for them. End quote. And that was what happened in New York in March 1792. It was done through Bank of New York because the BUS branch in the city wasn't due to open until April that year, although when it did open, it too was open-handed. Hamilton also promised to buy back any collateral Bank of New York got stuck with. On top of that, news arrived that the Dutch had just agreed to lend the US 3 million florins at 4% interest. While there was considerable fallout from the affair, the economy quickly bounced back. On the political front, the creation of the BUS and the ensuing speculation and crash had set Hamilton's faction, the Federalists, at the throats of the opposing faction, the Democrat-Republicans led by Jefferson. Not that that was anything particularly new. Ultimately, Jefferson's grouping, eager to preserve entrenched positions in the rural economy and fearful of a powerful centre, managed to strangle the BUS by preventing the renewal of its charter in 1811. They lived to regret it, and a second bank of the United States would open in 1816. But that's a whole other story. So, thank you for listening, and if you haven't already done so, you can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the main podcatching services. Do subscribe and convince me that I'm not just talking to myself. Any reviews will be gratefully received and eagerly read. And thanks also to Clive Carroll, whose piece All This Time supplies the musical backing to my rambling. Join me next time for more fun and games as we turn the clock back to Imperial Rome and review how the Emperor Tiberius takes a break from his sexual frolicking on the island of Capri and dons the hat of the central banker to head off the full-blown financial meltdown that is shaking the foundations of empire. Thank you, and see you next time.